Hi, just before the podcast begins, a quick note. Mike's audio does get rough here for about 10 minutes early in the show. Just letting you know that it will improve. And we're working on the technical problems here, but we're both English majors, and we hope to have them solved soon. Take care. Jazz.
Well, let's do this thing. Let's make this happen.
All right, let's do it. Welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast. I think it's 110.
Jesus.
I just call it Micapalooza. This is one where Mike has picked our four selections, and I think most of them are fairly recent, right?
Yeah, I think they're all in the last 2 years or something. So I have been able, through fair means and foul, to acquire things that turned up on the All Music 2016 Jazz Notable Albums of the Year list. And I just thought, I'm going to get anything I can find. And so these were the first four things I was able to get relatively easily off of that list. And so I think they're all 2016 releases.
No, the Sanchez has been around longer, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, no, that's right. That one was, sorry, that's a much older release. That I acquired a different way than I normally get discs. So yeah, I'm looking at this bad boy in front of me and it's 1998. So yeah, that was just, I guess, a little fiber in our diet since some of the other things are a little less gristly. So yeah, so the four selections are this David Sanchez disc from 98 called Obsession. And then a David Sanborn disc, pretty highly regarded in some circles, called Time in the River. And then this two-disc affair, live, Chick Corea and Bela Fleck, the banjo player. And then a very ECM-y ECM disc by Tord Gustafsson called What Was Said. So them's our four selections, and okay. three are from last year.
And so before we dive into them, I asked you to do your best, and you'll probably do better than I did, to guess my ordering of them from least favorite to favorite of these four. What is your supposition there?
I'm going to go with Tord Gustafsson at the very bottom of the list for you on account of its ECM-iness. And then it gets tricky. I am not as much of a Sanborn fan as you are, but you like some Sanborn. It's hard to know which David San you'd like more, Chez or Born. I'm gonna guess that you're gonna put Chick Corea one, and I could be wrong for all kinds of reasons, but I'm gonna guess you'd put Chick Corea as one, and then I'm gonna go with Sanborn two, Sanchez three, and Gustafsson four. So what's your ordering?
You nailed the Tord. Oh my God. Every time that album came on, I really wanted to hit something. And I'll talk about that in a minute.
Sorry.
How about What Was Punched? Next would be the Korea Fleck album 2.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And just to preface that, what you call 10,000 banjos at the bottom of the ocean. Good ballast for the 10,000 mandolins are already fucking through down there. That's what I call them. They're amazing players. We'll talk about it. But wow. And then for me, Sanborn was next only because I had these serious issues with Gustafsson and the Korea Fleck. We'll talk about it. I've never been a huge fan. I did have a couple albums growing up. I didn't pursue him a lot. And he's an interesting figure. I do feel like, and we'll talk about it in more detail, that I'm feeling his age a little bit on this one. And then,
oh yeah,
and for me,
I got issues with the sound. Yeah,
yeah, the Sanchez was the absolute top, and I was so happy it was there. I was like, oh good, okay, yes, hooray!
Yeah.
So
my ordering is only slightly different. I would have Sanchez at the top, and I would have reversed the Korea and the Sanborn, and then the Gustafsson at the bottom. Not because it's awful, just because it's so fucking
And I can certainly see it. I mean, if you're from certain points of view, I absolutely, there's a really good argument to make for the Fleck Korea album. I mean, obviously, they're kind of unbelievably talented musicians. So where would you like to begin?
Oh, let's go from bottom to top, your bottom to top.
Okay.
Let's start with Tord.
Yeah, he keeps me on the bottom, and I felt like I wasn't happy there. So talk a little bit about this very small group causing Nordic pain in anyone who listens to them. Tord plays.
That's a great question. You tell me. I forget. I honestly forget.
Okay.
I feel very stupid suddenly. Because I don't have the disc right in front of me.
He's the piano player, the keyboard player.
Okay.
And then he's got a drummer there. Who just doesn't want to live because he's not allowed to do anything. And then this woman who I considered her personnel listing would be vocals and hair because she's the only one that sports any. If you see a photograph of them, there's these two really depressed looking bald white guys and this pleasant looking woman with long brown hair who's like, I'm the only one who's getting any action. And after hearing this album, that's going to trickle away too. So, I cannot remember her name. I haven't pulled up the personnel, but it's a very unusual setup, right? Very minimalist, because even the drummer is not allowed to do much till about the back third of the album. A couple songs come up that actually have momentum or any kind of forward thrust whatsoever. Rhythm. Mostly these are what? Floating dirges? It's kind of, you know, Sinatra used to say that one of his albums should have come packed with a revolver for the suicidal. And this one, I feel like, comes with a bathtub full of warm water and a razor blade, right? It's just like, put it on and let it all go away.
So her name is Simin Tander, and she is German Afghan. And some of the songs are in English, and some of them are in, I think, an Afghan language. I'm going to say
Pashto.
And
then I read somewhere, and some she just makes up a language. I'm like, oh, great. What?
Yeah,
there weren't enough words in the universe of accepted languages that were depressing enough. You have to, like, coin your own fucking words. So,
Pat, how do you really feel?
I know. It's like, God damn, I hate this record. It's weird because I don't mind melancholy. I don't mind float. I think that my theory of it, real quickly, is that they're overdoing it. I mean, that she's a little too melodramatic is too strong a word, but if she was just singing it in a very pure vibrato-less voice and they were just letting the music do the work without weighting it with a certain portentousness or a kind of obtrusive melancholy, I think I'd like it better. But I really feel like it's, are you depressed yet? I'm rubbing your face in the depression. No, really, it's more depression. I just feel like they're selling it too hard, and it just seems, I don't know if it seems affected, but I don't like it. And there's certainly nothing here for me that has the pleasures either of jazz or of pop. I just, it's sort of like the most depressing church ever. The Church of Existentialism is now open. And welcome to our service. We don't give you communion. You bleed into the cup, okay? I don't know. So thoughts on this one.
I don't hate it anywhere near as much as you do. It's, of the four, the one I like the least. But that's because significant portions of it feel sort of noodly and forgetful. And it doesn't feel as if it has a great deal of jazz content. This is sort of ECM in its most world music iteration. Some things I like a little better than others. So there's a Rumi poem that's been set to music that the mood kind of pays off there for me. I think that one's What Was Said to the Rose. But I kind of like that. But for a lot of this, it feels very much like kind of mood music. And I tended to like it better when I couldn't really concentrate on the lyrics. When I could concentrate on them, they felt very po-faced. So when they're a little less, either they are sort of skirling out of the mists of the rest of the music, or as you pointed out, they're not in English, I tended to enjoy them better. Most of the time when they're in English, I think they draw a little too much attention to themselves, and I don't like it as much then. She's got a nice voice. I mean, it's a pleasant. It's not a bad voice.
It is. It's not that she's out of tune. It is that I feel like she is trying too hard to sell a mood in a way that just doesn't work for me. If she was a little, like I said, a little bit more letting the melodies and words do the talking without quite so much English, that's probably not the right phrase because it's confusing, this question of language, without enough spin on the ball. You know, I just felt like she's trying a little too hard to sell the catch in her throat or the vibrato or something, and it just seems intrusive rather than letting the mood come to you. And I feel like the kind of moods they're trying to create are either going to be extremely delicate and evanescent or just ponderous. And I feel like most of the time they come out ponderous. I did like, you know, when he finally gets down to like "The Way You Play My Heart." And roll, all of a sudden it's like you hear some gospel moves and the drummer is allowed to drum a little bit. And I do wonder too, would a bass have helped?
There might have been more backbone because so much of his playing is kind of just noodly and samey. And any fiber here, any backbone, I think would have contributed. There are times, especially for example on Roll, there are times where I thought, I kind of want to hear Brad Meldow's trio play this because I think they would fucking blow it up. They could take this mood and sell it, and they would sell it with intensity. It wouldn't feel noodly. It would feel urgent. And so much of this doesn't feel urgent. It feels contemplative, and mystical, and relaxing. Some of it makes me go to sleep. So I would have liked to, I think your idea there about a bass being here might have helped if the bass player was allowed to kind of kick everyone in the ass as opposed to just kind of underline blinkety blunk.
Right.
Everyone go to sleep now.
Yeah. I mean, the music they seem to intend to create, I guess I can understand why they don't have the bass there, but I'm just saying I don't like it. So I'd prefer that a bass be there. And I want to explain right now, I voluntarily listened to the Marble Index and Desert Shore by, is it Nico Nico?
Nico.
And you know, if a man can get through that and find some kind of pleasure, I'm just saying, I wish she'd been in the band and injected everyone with heroin and maybe it would have come out better. Again, it's a weird thing because at some point it literally gets down to, are you buying this? Because, you know, what they're doing is all about mood. As you say, he's not impressing one with harmonic invention or melodic invention or rhythmic invention. It is literally just plinkety plink. But do you buy into these voices as creating something that you will want to sit back and soak into? And I just know I don't like it. I want to get away from it. And it does seem like it's almost
having
like
said
a parody.
That,
yeah. Anyway,
for some people, this would be deeply pleasant. And they could put this on, and I could imagine some listeners just being deeply empathetic to this as a kind of rainy day coffee shop mood music thing. And so I could see some people really liking this, especially people for whom some jazz seems difficult or forbidding, like you have to understand something. This doesn't make those kinds of demands on you. It asks you to accept that a mood is being set, and you know, if your emotional weather chimes with that mood, I could see some people really loving this.
If they buy it, if they feel like this is working. I'm thinking of a video, and I'm going to go to a pet cemetery and a slow scroll past the tombstones, and here lies Fluffy, beloved pet. You know, it just seems almost parodic. And again, it's so subjective. I want to be, you know, I'm not saying these people can't play or that she's out of tune this amateurish. No, not at all. I'm just saying that when every single egg in your aesthetic basket is all we're creating a mood. There's nothing else there. There's not really, again, no melody to speak of, no harmony to speak of, no rhythm. It really has to sell. You know, you really have to convince the listener that this is working, because if you don't, there's nothing else there. And for me, for 2/3 of the album, that was the case. I just felt like this is just actively annoying me. But that's me. And it might be that if I listened to another 10 times, the ninth time, it would just click. And I'd say, oh, my God, I am there in that pet cemetery. And I really do miss Fluffy. And it's a gray day. And the clouds are just getting across the sky. And I just want to have some tea. But right now, it's more like Stephen King's Pet Cemetery. And I just want Fluffy to come back and kill them all. So anyway, I didn't like it. Go, Fluffy, go. Go, zombie cat. Kill them all. Or at least get them toupees. I don't care. One or the other. You know, maybe a big old fro would make these guys happier and they could play something rhythmic. I've got one other Tord album and it also has vocals. Yeah. And I just, because somebody was just saying, oh, this guy is so great. This is fantastic music. I was reading some review and I got it. And I'm like, not for me. Didn't like that. And then, yeah, this one's like, oh boy. Almost like the other one now in contrast. But yeah, I just, what Tord selling I ain't buying, at least based on these two. And I guess earlier stuff maybe was a little bit more gospel based, or, you know, I've heard, you know, talk that he's like coming out of a semi-religious tradition, that this is like some Lutheran backing. And musically, the Lutherans have kind of been on a losing streak since Bach, let's face it. So maybe that's a problem, you know. That's not the church where you go to get funk in your butt. Yeah, so Tord. What a name, you know? I'm just thinking, did you go to school in America? Because I know what the kids would have called you, but maybe where you went, Tord was okay.
Oh, dear. All right, enough of that. Let's move to something that's a little less painful for you.
Yeah, enough bastardry there.
So shall we turn to the Chick Corea double disc live set.
Epic. Oh my gosh. And
this exhausts, I think this would exhaust anyone's desire to hear piano banjo.
if you had that deeply perverted. You know, Bela, he married another banjo player and they had like a banjo baby. I'm like, that house is fucking hell, man. I'm like, it's like nowhere, everywhere you turn is banjos. Ah. Yeah, I remember hearing about him, God, 20 years ago, a kind of hip aunt and uncle of Joyce's were kind of into him. And he's kind of a figure who's obviously done a lot of bluegrass stuff, but also associated with kind of a hip fusion movement.
Yeah, he's done some jazz albums or jazz-oriented albums. I've got a couple. Yeah.
I mean, he's not a purist by any stretch. He's interested in a lot of different music. And according to what I've read and what he says during the recording here, and there's a certain amount of pattern. The one thing I really like about him is, like me, except with a huge amounts of talent, he's a little wobbly on pronunciation of words. He's like, how do you say that, Chick? You know, it's just awesome. Yeah. I'm like, you go. Okay, even smart, talented people have this problem, not just me. but yeah, it's like the flight of the cosmic hippopotamus or something. I'm probably misstating that, but that was kind of apparently a big breakout for Bela Fleck and the Fleck Tones. And then he said he's been a big fan of Chick Corea since being a kid. He was a major influence. And so now they're touring as a duet. And, you know, I've got recordings of Chick with Herbie Hancock from back in the 80s. They did a couple albums. And, of course, one I quite like with Gary Burton, a live album from Europe, a double album. So this is a guy that does like doing duets. And he's obviously got bottomless chops. And, of course, Bela does too. It's just, wow, Nota Palooza. One of the reviews I read just basically said he cannot overcome the basic problem of the banjo, which is notes don't sustain. And so if you're looking for the ballad selection, you're not going to find it here, right? You can't. There's certain emotional registers the banjo just can't pull off. And so there's a hell of a lot of pyrotechnics and notes.
So, you know, my feeling about this is we talk about different players having kind of different skill sets, and you know, some people are that spice that makes the paella go. Bobby Hutcherson plays great with others. Chick Corea, he does a lot of things really, really well. But you know, I'm hard pressed to think of another player who so often plays in duet settings with a really broad variety of people. He seems to flourish when it's his mind engaged with just another mind. Like,
right.
Like if it's just two, he can really concentrate and respond, and sometimes the response can be almost telepathic. So I forget the name of the disc. It's a couple disc live set of him playing in New York City, and he's got a bunch of people who come in and play with him. And one of the most memorable is Bobby McFerrin, who I got a real low tolerance for Bobby McFerrin. But he and Chick do two or three numbers together, and they do one of Korea's touchstone numbers, Armando's Roomba, which is also featured here. And the interplay between Korea and Bobby McFerrin on that number is just legendary. It's simply astonishing. Was doing amazing things on that song, and you know, the way that they respond to one another and mirror and mimic each other is just uncanny. And I remember when I listened to that, I think it's a two or three disc set recorded in New York City of Korea and other people, a kind of a celebration of his career. And I just thought, my God, this guy likes to play with one other person, and he's so good at it.
Yeah.
And like here, you know, it seems like it should be better than it is. And I think there's two problems. One is, as you point out, the banjo doesn't have a sustain. So that commits you to certain types of numbers. Okay, fine. I get that, and that's okay. Maybe there's a couple of features here that I really like quite a bit. I think their turn on Brazil is wonderful, a little long, but still wonderful. And I love their version of Armando's Roomba here. It's terrific. I think the other problem is the Bela Fleck on his own discs has the reputation of being something of a wild man. He's kind of unrestrained.
Well, that's
pay attention.
Sure, yeah.
Pay attention. Here we go.
Oh,
ah,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And he is a little bit, I think, too much in awe here of Chick Corea. There's a little too much deference, I think, this part, not just in the verbal bits back and forth, but I sense even a little bit in the playing. You know, Korea seems quite at home here and strikes sparks willingly. And I think Fleck is a little too deferential. And I wish he was a little more kill your daddy. He's a little too.
Yeah.
He's a little too willing to follow Korea's lead. He's too deferential. And he's too willing to follow Korea's lead as opposed to push him and surprise him. And he's certainly capable of that. And the biggest surprise here is Korea on the bus said he wanted to play some bluegrass, so they play some bluegrass, you know, and it's like, great, Korea shows that he can play in any genre, because I think Korea is capable of responding to those kinds of, you know, surprises and innovations, and I just think Fleck is too respectful. He's too much in awe here. It feels like he's a little dialed back, and I wish he wasn't. Like, maybe he needed to drink a little before.
That could be, yeah, and I just have not listened to Fleck before at all, really. I'm sure I've heard the occasional number, but never concentrated on his playing. And so this is like the only Fleck I've heard. And he's amazing technically. But of course, in general, we kind of think of the banjo as an instrument that is played quickly, right? An instrument that spits out a lot of notes. It's what it's known for. And it, in a sense, it almost has to, again, to generate a sound field, because any one note is a very brief, truncated occurrence. And you can't really put much spin on it. You can't do a lot with it other than pluck it. I just don't feel like you can shape the note the way you can with a piano or any wind instrument or a guitar. It just doesn't have those capabilities. And I really felt that through this very long sometimes a little cute or self-indulgent session. I mean, not that it was always the case, but I did feel like this was very much audience-facing, audience-pleasing music that, you know, at times approached kind of being almost stunt-driven. There were moments where they kind of worked a little bit to sustain or create a mood, but it did seem very much like we're going to unspool our incredible technical facility for you, and that there wasn't a lot beyond that. I mean, it wasn't like they were trying to probe into the heart of a given musical piece, or as you said, there wasn't a lot of sense of discovery or kind of struggle. It was just a lot of beautifully unspooling patterns.
No, it reminds me of a little bit, if you remember the Art Tatum Pablo group masterpieces. Art Tatum is an intimidating player, but he's best in those settings when the person who's playing with him isn't intimidated, and when the person challenging as he is, and when the person isn't, it's not good. So like Buddy DeFrancesco and Burnett, he and Art Tatum have a ball. I mean, they're challenging each other all the way through. But then, you know, a great player like Ben Webster, that is not a good setting for him. And Art Tatum kind of runs him over. And this isn't as bad as that, but I do feel like Bela is a little starstruck. And I wish he and Chick would have had a fight before the concert. Like Curry had told him he had bad hair or something. Yeah. Bela's like, fuck you, you know, and they'll come out a little more fire.
Right. And definitely that is, it's a very genial vibe. Yeah. There is no sense of, you know, another thing they're not trying to do is challenge the audience, right? It's not just each other. It's a sense that they're there to please a large group of people in a way to make sure that that large group understands they are being pleased and should be impressed. And there's a fair amount of recording of clapping, which I get to some degree, but, you know, at times it's like, well, the way this album was edited seems a little bit self-congratulatory. Did we really need the verbal bits? I noticed when I was doing a random selection, you're getting these, you know, 1.5 minute intros to a tune, and then of course it doesn't go on to it, which is not their fault, but just there's a certain amount of space taken up by this banter that is very polished and very middle of the road and pleasant, but not trying to startle or surprise or deeply inform you. It's just kind of a performance of genialness. And
it's not that funny. It's just not that. There's the one where they're gonna start on four, and you know, build like so on five, you know, and Chick's like the downbeat, you know, and they're like kind of doing this, you know, Abbott Costello routine, but it's not very funny, and it's not
right.
You know, it's like, okay, you guys like each other. I get it. I wish you didn't like each other a little bit, you know. Just a little bit.
And I'm always amused. I've heard Chick Corea's voice before. It's funny because you think of him as the pixie and this little guy who's magic. I mean, one of his albums is like called Leprechaun. And then he speaks. He's like, yeah, he's got this New York accent. Just very.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the guy.
He can't say Baylor. He says Baylor.
Yeah. And he's like the guy that brings your beef. Just very working class kind of New York accent. So it just doesn't somehow fit my picture of him. The guy that brought you Return to Forever, and he sounds like your plumber. You know, it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
So overall, it was impressive. I just, again, in the short time left to me, I don't want to spend a lot of that listening to banjo, period. And I don't, I just don't, you know. It's just like when I saw Chris Thiele with Meltdown, that album's come out now from the tour. I saw him on tour, the mandolin player who's now hosting Prairie Home Companion. And I just,
right.
Ultimately, I'm like, you're amazing. I don't like mandolin very much. Please go away, sir. It was an instrument that I did not want to have a lengthy exposure to. And it's just, I feel like in both cases, it limits so much the range of expression you can bring to it that it feels like a kind of straitjacket. And I know that, I guess one of Bela's goals was to kind of expand the range and repertoire of the banjo. And as far as I know, not being a student of it, he's done a fantastic job, but I just, at the end, I'm not sure the experiment works for me. I'm like, boy, you're really talented. Wish you played guitar. I mean, it's sad to say, but I guess what I'm looking for in music, especially instrumental music, I just rarely is going to be met by, certainly for stretches longer than 10 to 15 minutes, banjo. I just don't, it doesn't do the things for me musically I want music to do for me. So as amazed as I am by his ability, and it is, you know, it's jaw dropping. And I agree, these guys mesh fantastically. I think, you know, in a sense, because they aren't pushing the envelope ever harmonically, what you get is this cascade of consonant melodic ideas. They all fit in the harmonies, or they're often scalar or pattern based, and they are amazingly adept, but there isn't often that sound of surprise. And that's not to say it never happens. I mean, these guys are very talented, but I just, not a favorite. And also the cover's so ugly. I don't know. I mean, man, that's an ugly cover. Ugly cover. It's like, come on, guys. It just, we can get the fact it's live. You don't need to show us this plug ugly curtained area with lights. And I just, man, find something a little more charming for it. So just as a package, I'm a little dubious. All right, what's up? I guess we're up to David, huh? David Sanborn this time.
Up to David. So you'll have to remind me who's on this disc, because my computer is barely, for whatever reason, I'm freezing. So trying to look at anything is impossible. But yeah, for me, I actually like this less than the Chick Corea disc, in part because I really appreciate Chick Corea as a player and his ability to duet with just about anyone. And I think my beef with this album, with the David Sanborn album, isn't so much with his playing, which is pretty good. It goes to something slightly different. Sanborn was a stalwart in, you know, kind of the New York scene in the 80s and 90s. And he recorded a lot of jazz in that kind of electro synth echo pop chamber that a lot of jazz seemed to be churned out in the 80s and 90s. Not quite Kenny G echo, but in that region, very wet recordings. And this is as dry as it can be. It sounds like he's recorded it inside a cedar chest. There is no reverb here at all. I mean, it is really tight on the horn. Not so much on the other instruments, but the horn is just, the sound is so dry, which I like on the lower numbers. So like Ordinary People, the opener has, you know, he spends more time in the lower register. Sounds great. It's beautiful. I don't mind it at all. But then on other numbers, especially where he climbs into the higher registers on the horn, I start getting Jackie McLean flashbacks, and they're not good. He's nothing like a sharp. He's sharp, it's only a teeny tiny bit. It's the dryness of the sound that drives me nuts. I'm like, could you just have put a little reverb in there? I mean, we don't have to go full out Kenny G, but it's just so astringent. I wanted the sound to be a little wetter. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's closely mic'd, and I don't think David is in the voice now that he was, you know, all the way back to David. You know, when we talked about the saxophone and pop, one album that didn't get brought up was Young Americans by David Bowie, and the whole fucking album is basically one long David Sanborn solo. It's amazing. Right. It's just kind of an element of just every piece. And interesting that Bowie chooses him for his quote unquote plastic soul album. And, you know, certainly if you listen to Sanborn's lines there, I do feel like at times his imagination flags. He just kind of, he goes to some of the same gestures. And I want to be super clear here. Chick Corea is a more important musician to me than David Sanborn. I mean, clear, you know, I mean, I just think of them, I think Corea is vastly more talented. Not that I dislike Sanborn, and I think certain things he's done are kind of cool, but it's just that this album has no banjo. Let's just summarize real quickly here. There ain't no banjo here. And as an album, I like it slightly better, even though the talent level on display is not anywhere near the wattage of the Fleck Corea project. I want to be super clear about that. So, yeah, it's a Marcus Miller joint. So Miller, who's been playing bass forever, I think is the producer and the mastermind here. And I love the review in AllMusic, this contemporary soul thing. And I'm like, look, guys, this album is aiming at the 60 plus set. It's real clear. Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at the tunes they play that are standards.
Yep.
Can't Get Next to You.
Mm-hmm.
Windmills of Your Mind.
Carousel that's turning, running rings around the moon, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face, and the world is like an apple whirling silently in space, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind.
And you pronounce it the way the singer does, windmills.
Windmills of your mind, yes, windmills. She made a meal of it, and the overture from The Manchurian Candidate. So it really is like the stash of music they're reaching from is like 60s pop. I mean, it's way back there. This is this stuff is old seeming to me.
Yes.
And so I think Miller is, and the other thing I noticed, and I think I mentioned to you in an email, is this got reviewed in the Financial Times, which for some reason I just find hilarious. I was like, what? What? The Financial? And I'm just thinking, in a sense, yeah, this Sanborn kind of, and again, I think that he's a fine musician and he's done a lot of good work. I mean, for God's sakes, he was in Gil Evans' band for a while.
Right.
He's a likable enough figure. I mean, to me, when you were talking about Ben Webster, and I actually like the Ben Webster Art Tatum album, but it's you're absolutely right that it's oil and water there, right? They're completely different. But I think of Webster as a classic stylist in that his playing has a distinctive style, but I feel like every second that he's playing, he's expressing his Ben Websterness. And the way he plays, at least when he's on his game, I mean, of course, he had some bad nights, but there's always nuance, there's always detail, and there's always surprise. I mean, he's velvety and mellow, but at the same time, he'll growl at you, or his dynamics will swing wildly just briefly. It's a man expressing himself. And Sanborn, I think, more is not so much a stylist as someone who plays in a stylized way. He is kind of embodying a certain reduction of Hank Crawford's soul style. And he's kind of boiled it down to an essence that is extremely, it is a signifier of urban soul sax. But the signifier almost trumps the signified. I mean, he's got this amazing sound, and you know him in a note or two, but I don't know that it became a vehicle for really deep personal expression for him in a way that Ben Webster's style kind of brings the essence of Ben Webster to the table every time. I feel like Sanborn, in a sense, has kind of found a role to play, played it brilliantly, but in a sense kind of got trapped by it. And, you know, some of his career, especially in the last couple of decades, has been wandering away from the template, trying a little artsier stuff. Maybe I'll go with an organ trio. Maybe I'll go out here and do something that's almost avant-garde. Then wandering back to the fold, this is clearly kind of a, I don't even want to say update, but another slick, thoroughly produced, I think pleasant and successful, you know, reasonably well thought out pop album, right? It's he solos on it, but its focus is kind of urban groove.
And I will say there is one positive to the very dry sound, which is that it saves this from being smooth jazz.
Yeah.
If this had been an echo chamber, we're in Kenny G territory immediately. But the very dryness of the way it's recorded, in a sense, kind of gives it an edge that too much reverb would have killed, you know. Mm-hmm. And indeed, some of Sanborn's stuff from the 70s, from the 80s, sounds smooth jazzy on account of the way that it's recorded. And he saves from that here. I would have liked just a teensy, teensy bit of reverb here just to give a little more texture.
It's kind of audio verite, right? A little merciless, maybe you might call it.
That's a good term. It's merciless. I think it's merciless. Just his horn. It's not the rest of the.
Yeah, no, I agree. Absolutely.
Just his horn.
He is. Yeah, he's up there, and there is. It's a very naked, direct sound, and it's a little merciless towards us, and a little merciless towards him, which does give it a bite. And some of his soloing, I feel like in some of those passages where he just gets real squealy, I do feel like sometimes he's a guy that just doesn't naturally have 10 choruses in him. I feel like that after a while on any given performance, you kind of can hear the gears grind a bit, and he doesn't necessarily have loads of new fresh material to trot out. He gets a little bit into patterns or a little bit stuck in corners. And again, that to some degree, I feel like that happens a little bit, though. God bless him. I mean, I don't know who could have soloed as long as he does on Young Americans, where, as I say, it's just kind of amazing. You listen to some of these songs, it's like he just soloed all 4 minutes. I mean, he's in the background. Right. I mean, Bowie's foregrounded there, but it's like one of the tracks. It's just Sanborn soloing the whole time. And you kind of notice it's like, well, yeah, you know, I'm not sure that minute four, there's a lot of epiphanies left here. So I kind of felt that here that, you know, this is, it made me think about him as a player. You know, as a kid, he was a name you'd hear about, and I got a couple of his records, and then I just kind of didn't anymore. I wasn't like offended by him, but he wasn't somebody who caught my ears. You know, he wasn't somebody that warmed the cockles of my heart the way Dexter Gordon. I'm like, well, I'm always going to like Dexter now. I mean, I get everything he ever recorded, but I look out for Dexter. And David wasn't that way. And of course, it was, you know, his stuff back in the 70s or 80s was kind of, you know, was meant to be kind of commercial. It wasn't necessarily smooth jazz or easy listening jazz, but kind of slick. And yeah, here this is kind of the old gang back together. And man, as I said, it really does seem in some way consciously pointed at the wallets and minds and hearts of 60 plusers. I just, I'm not saying that's wrong, but it, in some ways I'm amazed there weren't stabs made at some kind of hipness by somebody that's, because, you know, Sanborn for a while hosted this music show. I remember seeing the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yeah.
On that and thinking, well, that's enough of that. I don't need to ever hear them again, but look, they're wearing socks on their penises. You know, it was like Night something. And I enjoy that show. I mean, and he seems like a likable guy. And I don't think that he's somebody who thinks he is God's gift to the saxophone and he's greater than Charlie Parker or something. At the same time, he's found himself a career and he's done very well in it. And he's, I think, done it with integrity. I don't feel like he's, you know, I'm not saying he sold out or something. It's just that's the way he wants to play. But yeah, the only reason this kind of edged out too was like a banjo. So. And okay. I think it's a pleasant, successful record. I mean, it's easy listening jazz. That doesn't mean there's no content to it, but it is easy to listen to, except for the few times that, as you say, the audio verity gets a little strong. You're like, whoo, I don't need a Q-tip now. Thank you, David. Okay, well, moving on to another David. This is the only one that's really kind of not 2000 teens, right? The only one that's right. Back from the 90s.
This is, I think, his first or second solo gig. He's been around now for a while. He's not a young lion anymore, but he's not quite middle-aged, I guess.
So younger, and he's not like a Marsalis age. He's younger
no.
than that.
And in fact, that's interesting. Branford and Delfeo are the producers here. And I think they deserve a lot of credit. Not that Sanchez doesn't as well. He certainly does. But this is a beautifully recorded album with some really good choices, I think. Because when you think Latin jazz, you think, all right, we're going to get tons of percussion. And we're going to, you know, get a lot of burners, a lot of fired up stuff.
And we do get some of those things, right?
We do get some of that. But, you know, the opener's lush string arrangement. We get lots of really plummy flutes all the way through this. And the thing that I thought of over and over again as I listened to this was, my God, Sophie should love this album.
Okay.
This would be an album that Sophie would really dig if she doesn't already know it. Because he's a thoughtful, melodic player who, he's not a screecher or a screamer, although he can. And he spends a lot of time, well, Sophie's got a kind of animus against living in the top, you know, third of the horn. And he does a lot of really expressive things here in both mid-tempo and up-tempo Latin numbers on, you know, in the bottom two-thirds of the register. And I love the way he's recorded. I love the way this sounds. It just is, it's just really full and ripe to my ears. And after the Sanborn, it was just like, you know, an oasis of pleasure. And none of the songs are too long. The longest is 9 minutes. The shortest is 5. They all come in around 7. It doesn't overstay its welcome. It's just under an hour. So it's probably about as long as I could pay attention to something like this. And it's just really pleasant. It's just a really enjoyable album through and through. I still feel like, and I don't know if you feel this way, I still feel like I haven't quite mastered or come to terms with Latin jazz. And on the liner notes, Sanchez is very clear, you know, this is an album about my Puerto Rican roots. So, you know, this is Puerto Rican and Cuban and a little bit of Brazilian jazz. So he's very clear about, you know, what he's after here. You know, he's paying homage to people that matter to him. And I respect that, but I just like his playing here a lot. I think he sounds beautiful. And I love the way he kind of carries over. A lot of his lines will carry over from like certain swells in the strings or in the arrangement. So he'll like sort of carry from chorus to chorus. And I find him really engaging here. On the other disc we listened to, it didn't quite connect for me in the way this one seems to. And maybe I just didn't have enough time with that one. Not right. Sure.
Yeah, we did a Street Scenes back on episode 48. So this is the second one from that same era, roughly. Street Scenes was 96, and this is like 98.
And I recall we didn't have, neither one of us had a good feel for that. We didn't dislike it, but we didn't have a real sense of...
I think this is stronger.
I think it is stronger. Yeah. I still don't feel like I have a good grasp, but this just hit pleasure centers for me in ways that I don't recall that previous album doing. And I now have, I think, 4 or 5 albums by him, not counting the stuff where he plays with the San Francisco jazz. He's part of that unit from time to time. And that's where I first heard him live in that setting. So I think I have that right. Now that I said that, I'm afraid it's wrong. But I think he's played with them. I'll have to check. But yeah, this is really enjoyable. I don't know. Did this give you pleasure like it does for me?
Oh, yeah. You know, the one thing about programming that I think was a bit misleading or odd is it opens with a very lush, beautifully orchestrated ballad, great bottom end to it, nice textures. And my theory is if you're going to then bring out the bongos and congos for like 4 minutes straight later on and get things pretty spicy, I don't know that I want to lead with a ballad, because the impression I was getting from that is this is going to be a super mellow ballad album. And it wasn't. It was a real mix of cushionier things and more vigorous workouts with lots of percussion and a fair amount of energy, not squealing. I mean, it's all well recorded. And to me, I think it's fine to have that mix. It's great. It just somehow it seemed odd to begin with the ballad. To me, it's like, let me know in a record how wild it's going to get first and then change the mood on me as you go. That's great. But if you start me off that mellow, I'm going to kind of assume, I guess, for whatever reason, the table has been set for a makeout record the whole way through. And it really isn't. Which is, I mean, I like that. I you know, it's literally just, if I was in charge of the world, I would have put a different track first, is all I'm saying. I mean, I like all the tracks. They all work. You know, I've heard him described as, he's kind of a player out of almost a Sonny Rollins school. He's got a big, firm tone, good melodic ideas. He's a likable player to listen to, at least at this stage. I'd love to hear him, like, what's he sound like now in the teens? Later on, but
just to add something on the Sophie catalog, you know, Sophie pointed out in one of our sessions with her that if you're going to live in the upper register of the horn, play the fucking soprano. And so he does.
Right. Yes, he
brings up the soprano. And it's like, okay. And he's good. He's good on the soprano. I like his soprano playing. I don't know if you liked it.
Yeah, no, I think it was fine. And I have been Googling here, and it sounds like that he does appear at least some of the time with the SF Jazz Collective, which is just a fine group that you've brought a great recording to the table with, and we've praised to the skies. Yeah, I like his conception. I like the way he improvises. I think it's got good, strong classical roots. you know, I don't know if you asked me to identify him, I've heard enough to be able to say, oh, that's David. But this project I liked quite a bit. And as I said, it does get peppy sometimes. And there's a couple moments there where there's just a 2 or 3 minutes of percussion workout, nothing else. I mean, just really intense. And I do wonder, too, I think if I knew Latin American music and some of their standards, I'd be saying, oh, my gosh, here's his treatment of so-and-so. This is neat. Look what he did with this old war horse. But not knowing them, then it's kind of like it's good music. I like it, but I'm not getting the kind of cultural resonance I would be if I was familiar with this repertoire, because my sense is he's kind of bringing up classics from these different cultures and arranging and putting a spin on them. And I miss that level of it because I'm ignorant. But yeah, as a record, I think it's pretty successful. And again, as a player, he's somebody, I think more so from this project than the first one, that I'd like to pursue more and listen to more from. He's likable. And of course, Sophie, that Mike's referring to, Sophie Fought, the great Indianapolis saxophone player. I think we're going to have to bring her back. We keep talking about the poor thing behind her back.
I'm going to be careful because she hated the things I mentioned last time.
I know. Time, so. It hurt your feelings. It's okay.
I'm wounded. I'm tender in tender places as a result.
Hey, at least you didn't play banjo for her. God knows what the reaction would have been. She probably loves him. Probably be less one of her favorite musicians. I don't know. Anyway, as tenor players go, I like him a lot. And I feel like his relationship to improvisation is pretty uncomplicated. I don't feel like he's somebody who's struggling to create a new sound or approach. He's just kind of playing, and he sounds good when he does it. So, you know, I don't know. I haven't studied to see, is this derivative? Am I hearing licks from other players? I don't know that I am. But, you know, he's kind of comfortably in the Rollins school, and he just plays very well within it, with obviously, an interest in the rhythms and musics of his cultural background, which is evidently kind of complex. And I like Latin jazz. Some of the arrangements remind me a little bit of some of the sounds on Paul Desmond's From the Hot Afternoon album, an old classic from A&M. Apparently that was Don Sebesky, whatever his name is, the guy that kind of ran CTI or was one of the main arrangers for them.
Right.
And, kind of lush, burbling flutes. And you hear moments of this album, but it's not all about that. As I said, it's not an album that, whereas From the Hot Afternoon is one long Latin bath, all very mellow, as most of what Desmond did after Brubeck was very mellow. You know, this has got kind of different moods and different intensity levels, but it's all well done and all recorded. And it's not like he ever gets into avant-garde screaming or something. It's just some of it's peppier than others. All of it is peppier than Tord. Oh, my God. Okay. But, yeah, interesting group. Mike has been threatening to do an alt ECM show again, so brace yourselves, listeners. Are you ready?
I think we need to. I think it needs to happen.
It's like the
Spanish Inquisition. I think we need to do it, and there's enough fiber. Look, the alternative is to have ECM discs polluting other things we do.
Like marshmallows floating in her hot chocolate.
Yeah, and I feel like
eat the bag of marshmallows now.
Exactly, and then we can just have
no
hot chocolate.
No s'mores for you, bitch. You're just right. Nothing but
we can have hot chocolate with schnapps in it, and then we don't have to worry about the marshmallows. We should just do an all marshmallow episode. I think I've got enough things selected that will hold your interest, even though they're ECM. That
you know what's really distinctive about marshmallows? They're so fucking white. I'm just saying.
Wow, isn't that a pleasant thing to say? Oh my goodness!
Like, there's an XTC album called White Music, and I think Man, Tord is a pale dude, a pale rider on a pale horse with bad news for humanity. All right, well, we made it. What kind of pop stuff, if any, is on your mind right now?
Let me look back. Open up my little iTunes here and see what I've been listening to. For whatever reason, Weird Al Yankovic's Mandatory Fun came up again. I just love that disc. I think he's really good at that. I just like that stuff. No, the thing that I listened to recently, pop-wise, that is really good, I think, that I really enjoy, is A Tribe Called Quest's 2016 release, We Got It From Here, Thank You For Your Service, kind of a tribute, partial tribute to the death of one of their members.
Sounds like a group I'd like, but one I've never
gotten. Yeah, so I have Low End Theory, and then I just got We Got It From Here, and there's some good stuff on here. There's some really good stuff on here. My favorite song. So this is the second rap album I've picked up, or hip hop album I've picked up recently, that has a shout out to Donald Trump on it. This one, the final song, is called The Donald. And it's quite interesting. But the best song for me so far, the opener, The Space Program, is really good. They have a song called Solid Wall of Sound with samples Elton John's Benny and the Jets. And oh my God, I can't get that song out of my head. It's a fucking earworm. They just have that bit of the chorus where he's, you know, where Elton John is screaming out in Solid Wall of Sound. And that's the repeated sample. Okay. And it's, and but it's set to this hip hop beat that you've got Elton John sampled. And God, it is an earworm. It is such a good song. Great lyrics, great sound. So I like this album a lot. And then I shared with you, of course, this other hip-hop album. I shared one song with you, which I don't think you listened to, otherwise you would have talked about it. YG, Young Gangsta's Still Brazy. And someone, a student, schooled me on the whole BC thing. It's a Bloods Crips Los Angeles thing, and Bloods substitute B for C in words all the time, you know. So one of the songs on here is called Bool Bomb and Bolective. Yeah, I know. Anyway, yeah, I gave you FDT, which once you hear it, you will never get it out of your head, because FDT stands for the chorus, which is fuck Donald Trump, fuck Donald Trump, just over and over and over again. And when you hear it, it's in your head. And I think this song is the shit. I can't play it before classes because, you know, I really don't want to end up on Professor Watch List. But my God, that's a good song. And I enjoy this album quite a bit. So, the two pop matters for me have been these two albums from last year. We Got It From Here by A Tribe Called Quest, and Still Brazy, which I'm getting deeper into all the time. And there are plenty of good songs on there. But for me, FDT, just I cannot get that song out of my head.
God bless him.
It's a great chorus. It's just... Oh my God. In fact, I shared it with other faculty, and several people said they want to make it their dial tone on their phone. You
know? I don't know if I can do that around here. He's a hero, right? Apparently they had this article in the Times where like, yeah, all these farmers out in California voted for Trump. And now they're like, but you really weren't serious about the immigration thing, were you? Cause like all our workers are, oh shit. Oops. Thought you were kidding about that part. Yeah, I remember years ago, Public Enemy did a song about Bush that was just like, he's a bad, bad man. And it was a kind of a cute number. We should have a lot of that in the next few years. So I am meaning to listen to Malibu. I have not gotten it done yet. I'm looking forward to it. It sounds, at least the beginning of it, was kind of like, wow, this sounds like kind of a guy almost doing Bajuism or something. It was pretty groovy and soulful, so I'm hoping I enjoy that when I get to it. The one album I did download and listen to, Steve Wilson, he of Porcupine Tree, Mr. Remix, who's did all the King Crimson albums,
and then
moved on to Jethro Tull, decided it was time to do Chicago 2. And
oh dear.
Yeah, I was like, okay, well, all right, well, you're interested in this. I guess I've never thought of listening to a Chicago album before.
I like early Chicago.
I do,
and
too.
That's why I made that oh dear sound, because early Chicago, the horns are fucking awesome, and I don't want to hear anyone fuck that shit up.
Oh, well, in general, he's not a wild revisionist. What he tends to do, and of course, the thing is with this one, I don't know, except for a couple ones. Somebody gave me a really nasty sounding CD of their greatest, and not that person's fault, it's the CD master's shit, of their greatest hits. And I like early Chicago, too. I like those hits. And so a couple of those, of course, appear on this album. And it's like, yeah, as far as I can tell, he did only good. They sound better, but they don't sound wildly different. It's just he's clarified things a lot. And of course, he tends to be drawn to projects where there's a lot of dense information on the recording that maybe back in the 70s was a little bit muddled or a little bit congested sounding, and he tries to pull out. I mean, the real miracle work he did for King Crimson was Lizard, which I used to have an old tape dub of. It was just garbage, and it's still a weird, problematic record, but he made like 20 times more interesting when you could hear what was actually going on. It's like, oh, okay, this is at least strangely compelling and odd. So anyway, I listened to Chicago 2, and I've never listened to a Chicago album through. It's their second record. I think originally it was just called Chicago, because the original album was Chicago Transit Authority. And
that is correct.
The CTA didn't like that, and they said cease and desist. Apparently, their first three albums were doubles. Then they released a four-album live set. And then for Chicago 5, they went to a single album. Like, holy shit. And of course, if you've been around in the 90s and the 80s, they became kind of a power ballad factory. And
right. When Drippy, Peter Cetera basically took over the band.
Yes, the bass player did it. And apparently, there were a couple reviews of this. I read this quote where Jimi Hendrix was talking to them back, and you know, when he was still living, of course, and said, "Wow, your horns—they breathe like they got one lung, and the guitar player is better than I am." And you know, the guitar player is really, really quite good. And he didn't mention the vocals or the lyrics. And yeah, I mean, that's the story of Chicago. Is it the horn? Just every time I hear those horns playing, I feel happy at some primal level.
Yeah.
And I think it has to do with growing up in the 70s. What's your all-time favorite Chicago song?
There are several. So the number song, because it's just got those soaring horns in it.
Oh, yeah, three, right. Two. 25 or 6 to 4. Great illustration. So that's on Chicago 2. And it turns out, what is that song about? It's about somebody at 24, 5 or 6 to 4 in the morning trying to write a song.
Mm-hmm.
You can read all sorts of things into it, but it's like, yeah, that's about as deep as Chicago gets, right? It's like, yeah, it's 20. Mm-hmm. It sounds really cool, the song. It's like, so that's a really good one. Yeah, that's a fantastic song. And there's some amazing guitar on it as well as the horns, yeah.
Yeah, the guitarist left or died or
shot himself accidentally.
Yeah, I remember that once he left, Cetera more or less takes over, and they don't descend into top 40 bathos immediately, but they begin to head there. But yeah, it's worth Googling YouTubes of them live at the beginning, and they weren't just that horn section wasn't just good to hear. They're fun to watch. They got like some dance moves, you know, like they don't just play in unison. They kind of move in unison and shit, and they don't dress the same, you know. They all look like hippies, but they can blow like motherfuckers.
Amazing.
And they have
sound.
These sort of, oh yeah, there's just like a wall of horn. It's
so good.
And then
like the opening number on this one, they go into a series of solos, and apparently Chicago Transit Authority does lots of jamming. And then this is a much more tightly focused record. And the alto, the reed player who plays a very good flute and very good sax, he basically plays Eric Dolphy for a while. Is really that out. It's like, what the fuck is this? And then the horn player, you know, I think the trombonist comes in, or the trumpeter, with a very, very accomplished, very rounded, pretty solo. But that first one's like, whoa, okay. You know, and they don't really go back to that well very often. But this one's got some long, it's got several suites on it, three. And one, the ending one is just basically kind of a war protest song that is, again, it's just weird. The vocalists, none of them are really gifted. I guess Cetera was the most, but even he is not an amazing singer. And the other guys are kind of growlers trying to do kind of a white soul sound. And you can just hear the awkwardness. I mean, they can do it, but they can't do it well. And they can't do it with nuance. And then the lyrics are just kind of trapper keeper. Man, why can't we all get together and see what's real kind of stuff? I mean, it's just, for the most part, not good. You know, they just aren't.
Right.
But the singing is, the harmonies are good, and the band is amazing. You know, the drummer's good, and, you know, it's just a really well-put-together band. And some of the music in it is pretty interesting. I mean, there's a couple, like AM Morning with a U and PM Morning or something, you know. And it's kind of like classical, and it's not bad like classical. Just instrumental sections that go on for like maybe 4 minutes total or something. So it's just a weird melange of things. And of course, there's a lot of ambition there, and some of the songs I really like. I mean, my all-time favorite is Saturday in the Park. It's kind of, to me, I love the 25 or 6 to 4, but if you know the one song for me that's that kind of encapsulates what Chicago's about, it'd be that song. And that one, again, the lyrics aren't brilliant, but they say what they're trying to say very well. And they don't, you know, they're not quite so preachy. They're not quite so on the nose, but the message is very clear. I mean, this is kind of a anti-war, pro-hippie band early on. It's just kind of hard to imagine the people that brought You're My Inspiration. Mm-hmm. But they were kind of protest-oriented hippies who just happened to go to music school, or sound like it anyway. So it was fascinating. I'm not going to gobble up a lot more Chicago albums. A lot of people think this is their absolute peak. I like most of it, but I wonder what would have happened if they had a charismatic, talented vocalist who could write lyrics. I mean, they would have been.
What if Daryl Hall had been their lyricist?
Well, I mean, exactly. It's like all these guys are like Daryl Hall after he's been beaten by the Yakuza, and then, you know, just kneecapped.
Because, you know, Daryl Hall is like White Soul. He could have fronted a band like that, and then when they went to ballads, he could have sold it.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have written such crap either.
No one's in his area code. No one is.
No.
And of course, I mean, in a sense, that was a group that was literally all about the vocalist, right? And then the backing band was kind of, this is kind of the opposite. It is a typical art band problem, prog band problem, which is everybody in the band has to be good at actually playing an instrument. And that typically means no one's actually any good at singing. You know, it
means you get Adrian Belew singing, you know.
Yeah, there you go. Well, and I noticed, you know, we've lost several musicians recently. This is going to be in your rearview mirror now by several weeks by the time this is published. But John Wetton, Asia, but before that, King Crimson and other groups, and Maggie Roach. Heartbreaking to hear Maggie Roach is gone.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, just she was.
Maggie was the low-voiced Roach.
She was. She was probably. I tend to think of her as the older sister who was kind of at the beginning, the aesthetic mastermind. And as time went on, Suzy and Terry took on more writing duties and did very well. But there are times when Maggie's singing, I'm just like, okay, I love you so much, Maggie. You and Pitch become better friends, but I love you. but she'll. Yeah, I'm just. It's just kind of sad to see that hear that she's gone.
And that concludes episode 110 of the Jazz Bastard podcast. As always, you can reach us at mike@jazzbastard.com or pat@jazzbastard.com or, of course, on Facebook. You can download the podcast from www.jazzbastard.com or from iTunes. Tune in next time for an all-ECM episode, Just As Mike Threatened, where we discuss works by Kenny Wheeler, Keith Jarrett, Jacob Bro, and Tim Byrne. Until next time, take care.
The only other thing I had on my mind was a couple very quick rants. One, we talked about Bob Dylan's first album of Frank Sinatra associated dancers.
He's done another?
Oh no, he did another, and now, Mike, now he's releasing a triple album of more. A triple album.
That's not, you know, this is a big finger to the Nobel Prize Committee, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
This is his way of saying, you know what? I'm Bob Dylan. Fuck you. That's what he's saying.
I'm too busy. I can't pick up your prize because I'm recording some just mind-bendingly painful stuff. That's the ultimate fuck you. Also, instead of attending, I'm going to send you my new triple album of Morris Sanders.
No one can Which you no it. Doubt will pick up at some point,
no,
I'm sure.
No, and of no, course, I don't think so. No.
Well, the critics are going to orgasm all over it, even Ugh. Though we already know how painful it's going to be.
It's
going to
sound like they already did, won't it? Anyway, it's an experiment. I get it. And there are things to enjoy about that first release, but really...
There's a lady who's sure all that glitters is gold, and she's buying a stairway to heaven. When she gets there, she knows if the stars are all closed. With the words, she can get what she came for.
And then the other thing, I may have talked about this before, I really hate it when a cliche makes it into the discourse that doesn't actually fit the facts. So I've seen this before, and then I heard another source saying, it doesn't make any sense, like that line from Stairway to Heaven, bustle in your hedgerow, what does that even mean? And I'm like, that makes perfect fucking sense. What does he say? If there's a bustle in your hedgerow, what's a hedgerow, people? It's plantings. What's bustle? It's a sound of, you know, shaking or moving about. Don't be alarmed. It's just a spring clean for the May Queen. He's just saying fairies or little animals are down there and they're getting ready for some kind of pagan thing. But it makes sense. A bustle in your hedgerow means you hear some kind of shaking in the shrubbery, okay? It's not hard to figure out. That isn't nonsense. It's ridiculous. It's silly, but it's completely coherent. Anyway, I just saw that again. I'm like, come on, what the fuck?
You need to dial back the sugar intake, I think, before the next podcast. Holy shit, what the fuck was that? You just had a little rant about something. Okay.
Just bother. I mean, for God's sakes, Led Zeppelin, not a complicated band. Their lyrics aren't that complicated. Bustle in your hedgerow. Makes sense. All right.
Decaf. Look into it. What the fuck?
Definitely. Holy I shit. Told you. I warned you. It was a rant. I didn't say it was a rant about anything important. I just said it was a rant.